think I can win because I've got 40 years of working on these issues in Alaska, of helping Alaskans across the board solve our problems.
A state policymaker tries to take his experience to the U.S. Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 10th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the state considers suing Xerox over a bungled Medicaid billing system.
What has happened is this new whiz-bang state-of-the-art system doesn't work.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
A bill to ensure hunters have access to federal land was blocked in the U.S. Senate today, even though nearly half the Senate had co-sponsored it. Senator Lisa Murkowski crafted the bill with Democratic Senator Kay Hagan of North Carolina. Murkowski was upset after the bill was derailed in another round of an ongoing Senate fight over whether to allow amendments, in this case, amendments about gun control.
Oh, I am frustrated. I am angry. I'm ticked.
Murkowski says she and Hagan always said senators would have a chance to add in their home state issues on the floor. Because the bill didn't go through any committees, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, though, blocked any changes. Murkowski and other sponsors then voted to prevent their own bill from advancing.
If you're going to be kind of loosey with the football here, that's just not acceptable.
Reid says Republicans couldn't agree among themselves on amendments. Murkowski says Reid was getting pressure from fellow Democrats to add gun control measures.
To avoid the kind of the breakdown within his own conference, he just decided the safest thing to do is have no amendments at all.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich co-sponsored the bill and said he was disappointed amendments weren't allowed. The bill would have also made it easier to get duck stamps and precluded the EPA from ever regulating lead ammunition and tackle. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell is the only Republican running for U.S. Senate who has actually won elected office before. Still, his fundraising is eclipsed by the candidacy of a former friend, ex-Alaska Attorney General Dan Sullivan, and he labors to prove he's as conservative as rival Joe Miller. APRN's Liz Ruskin has this profile of Mead Treadwell.
Some people go into politics for prestige, some for power. Talk to Mead Treadwell for a while, and it's clear he just loves policy. Ocean policy, Arctic policy, global issues. You can hear it when he tells of how he first came to Alaska, on vacation with his grandmother and brother. He says he read Wally Hickel's book on the ferry going north.
For me, the book was incredibly relevant about the giant issues of the day.
He was impressed with its discussion of energy security and environment, and with Hickel, who, as Interior Secretary, stood up to Nixon. Treadwell knocked on Hickel's door and wound up working on his campaign for governor.
So I ended up doing a lot of writing with him, and the very first assignment they gave me was, we're involved in a fight for the 200-mile limit now.
The Outer Continental Shelf, international policy, a treaty called Law of the Sea. Treadwell was in heaven. But there was still a summer vacation to complete. He and his brother went hiking near Kantishna.
And I'm sitting there on a mountaintop watching Denali do her tees. And, with the clouds, and you can see the mountain. Now you can't see the mountain. And my brother.
It's a story he tells often.
And I said to my brother, I don't need to live anywhere else. This is kind of the best of all worlds. It has the policy challenges, the business challenges. It's incredibly relevant in the world, and I decided then and there I was going to be an Alaskan.
It was 1974, and he was 18 years old. Treadwell did become Alaskan after Yale, where he wrote a senior thesis on Law of the Sea. He's had a varied career: Anchorage Times reporter, deputy DEC commissioner under Hickel, co-founder with Hickel of Yukon Pacific Corporation, chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, entrepreneur. Anchorage writer and talk show host Michael Carey says as a candidate, Treadwell struggles to sound like a regular Alaskan. All three Republicans in the race went to elite universities, but Carey says on Treadwell it shows.
He's a big picture guy that talks about the Arctic and some of the Hickel themes, and I wonder if that really is appealing to the Republican base.
Former Anchorage District Attorney Ed McNally has been his friend since Treadwell's freshman year at Yale when they both participated in CREW. McNally says it's easy to see why Lewis Meade Treadwell II strikes some as a privileged preppy.
East Coast, Ivy League, even the name, right? It has that ring to it, and I probably thought that. And he had a very humble childhood.
Of course, adversity is relative. Treadwell grew up in Newtown, Connecticut. His father, a businessman, served as first selectman, akin to mayor. When Treadwell was 15, his dad was killed in a house fire. But Treadwell, in fact, did go to a prep school, Hotchkiss, then Yale, and eventually Harvard for an MBA. Maybe it's his fondness for policy or just his manner, but even supporters acknowledge Treadwell doesn't always light up a room. McNally, though, says these days Treadwell is far more passionate.
Whatever was once the stereotype of a reserved Connecticut, maybe even East Coast or WASP, is long gone. And I think Carol probably brought some of that to him. Carol was unabashedly, exuberantly out there.
Carol was Meade's wife, who died 12 years ago of brain cancer. They had four children, one of whom died in infancy. McNally says the couple were yin and yang, her ebullience against his reserve. McNally thinks Treadwell became more like Carol for his kids, or maybe their Carol DNA emerged and rubbed off on him. Treadwell likes to say his children raised him well after Carol died.
At the time she died, Natalie was in kindergarten, Will was in first grade, Tim was in fourth grade, and I had three kids and a minivan.
He mentions that minivan a lot during campaign appearances. It's very regular guy. Though Treadwell is an incumbent in statewide office, he's had trouble raising funds. Treadwell let two of his campaign professionals go this spring and is the only candidate to have put in a significant amount of his own cash, more than $200,000 as of April. He says former DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan seems to have a lock on most of the outside donors. Still, a recent poll showed him neck and neck with Sullivan. Treadwell says it's not all about money.
I think I can win because I've got 40 years of working on these issues in Alaska, of helping Alaskans across the board solve our problems.
With rival Joe Miller staking out the far right of the spectrum, Treadwell strives to show he's as pro-life and against gay marriage as anybody. He can't, though, match Tea Party dogma denying climate change. As head of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, Treadwell wrote that emissions from burning fossil fuels were speeding climate change. Now, as he has for years, he says that's just one factor. But he's not a clear-cut climate denier.
I don't think it should hurt me. But I will tell you, I am a denier of the concept that raising your taxes or putting any sort of rationing on your energy use is an appropriate role for government at this point. I believe government's role is to help move technology along to make energy cleaner.
His views have U-turned on the very first Alaska policy he ever worked on, the Law of the Sea Treaty. Tea Party conservatives despise Law of the Sea. Joe Miller calls it a power grab by the United Nations. Treadwell, after advocating for ratification for decades, now says he is troubled it would require the U.S. to pay a tax to the U.N. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The governor's office may sue Xerox Corporation for the bungled rollout of a new system to process Medicaid claims. The Enterprise Medicaid Management System was supposed to replace the state's antiquated 30-year-old computer program. It went live on October 1st last year, and Commissioner Bill Struer says it had problems right from the start.
What has happened is this new whiz-bang state-of-the-art system doesn't work. So they're supposed to be fixing it. And it's simply not going fast enough.
The state handles millions of Medicaid claims each year. Stewart says the Xerox system is paying only about 60% of those claims. He says it should be easily handling over 80% of the so-called clean claims that meet all the criteria to be legally paid. The problems with the system have been a big burden to many providers who aren't receiving payment for their Medicaid claims. The state has had to hand out $135 million to providers in advanced payments until the system is fixed. Enstra says the glitches with the system have taken a lot of staff time to address.
Because instead of working with providers and ensuring that the services are delivered appropriately and in the right ways, we've had to work on making sure claims were getting paid and manually adjudicating those claims and those kinds of things. So, yes, it's been a struggle.
The state has paid Xerox $12 million of a $36 million contract. Stewart says the state is withholding the rest of the money until the system is working correctly. A spokesperson from Xerox would not agree to a recorded interview. In a statement, she said, quote, "We are working with the state to address its concerns." Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare marine mammal sighting in Prince William Sound.
I just could not believe my eyes. I kept thinking to myself, well, I must be seeing something wrong.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A move by the State Department of Transportation to demolish two houses in an Anchorage neighborhood has become a political issue. Two Democratic legislators, Senator Johnny Ellis and Representative Les Guerra, have written to DOT Commissioner Patrick Kemp asking that the department hold off on the demolition. Guerra says the three buildings are together assessed at more than $2 million, and coupled with the cost of demolition, destroying them is just throwing money away.
We're just asking the Parnell administration to not be reckless with spending. You know, the project hasn't been approved. It's contingent on a federal loan that's very difficult to get. And before demolishing $2.5 million of homes that they condemned and took away from people, those residences and homes might very well be worth the state selling if it turns out they don't get the federal loan.
DOT announced last week it was moving ahead to demolish or remove the two houses and an old motel to make way for the right-of-way for the proposed Kinnick Arm Crossing. At the time, the Government Hill Community Council, which opposes the Kinnick Arm Crossing, announced its opposition to the demolition. Stephanie Kessler is president of the Government Hill Community Council.
Those two homes are an anchor of Government Hill neighborhood, and they're attractive homes, and they are very important to our neighborhood.
Kessler says the majority of the community council wants to keep the houses intact. She says she has no problem with the demolition of the old motel, but she wants the houses to stand until it is certain the Kinnick Arm Crossing will become a reality. Kessler says if the houses are torn down, it implies that the bridge is a given.
And it's not inevitable. In fact, it's far from inevitable. And so if those houses are destroyed now and the bridge doesn't go through, Government Hill is just left with this grassy scar of where those homes were, and they would have been unnecessarily demolished.
DOT spokesperson Shannon McCarthy says by demolishing the buildings now, DOT is attempting to save property management fees and repair costs. While Alaska is known for its oil, it is also home to another energy source, hydrokinetic power, which uses turbines to harness energy from tides, rivers, and waves. Four separate test projects are underway this summer, and many more could be just around the corner. APRN's Joaquin Palomino looks at why Alaska leads the way in hydrokinetic research and what's driving growth in the industry.
Engineers have tried to harness the power of pounding waves and shifting tides for generations. And with 90% of the nation's tidal power and a good chunk of its wave and river energy, Alaska's quickly becoming the epicenter for this new technology.
We are clearly the ocean energy, hydrokinetic energy leader in America.
Doug Johnson, director of business at the Ocean Renewable Power Company, is working on 4 hydrokinetic projects this summer, from the Aleutian Islands to Yakutat. One along the Kvichak River near the town of Igiagig could provide about half of the energy needs for the 50-person community.
If it's successful, you could literally turn the diesels off and use diesel as backup power. It's just a really excellent way to provide energy to the community. There's no emissions, and there is really no negative impacts that we've seen so far from these devices in the water.
Despite its technical name, hydrokinetic power is pretty straightforward. It's basically just a turbine placed in water. As the current or wave moves it, electricity is made. Like any new invention, hydrokinetic power is pretty expensive, but in rural Alaska, where people pay a premium for energy, it could still pencil out.
A lot of renewable energy technologies that don't work elsewhere will work here cost-effectively.
Sean Scaling is with the Alaska Energy Authority.
They'll probably start competing a little bit faster in Alaska than someplace else that might have a lower cost of energy.
While this summer's projects target small, rural communities, Anchorage is next to one of the greatest untapped sources of renewable energy in the country, Cook Inlet. Tom Raven is a civil engineering professor at the University of Alaska.
Supplying the electricity for Anchorage, say, a city of 300,000 people, with Cook Inlet would be relatively easy to do because that resource is tidal. It's happening every day of the year.
Anchorage currently relies largely on nearby natural gas reserves for its energy. As those wells deplete, tapping Cook Inlet for electricity could look more and more attractive, Raven says.
The oil supply in Alaska is going to run out. I've always hoped that there would be enough vision in the state of Alaska that they would seize this opportunity where they have all this oil wealth to take some of those funds and basically invest in renewable energy on a large scale.
Alaska plans to generate half of its electricity from renewable sources by 2025. To help meet that goal, Ocean Renewable Power Company is looking for ways to connect Cook Inlet tidal generators to the rail belt, which supplies 80% of the state with electricity. Hydrokinetic tests along the Kvichak and Tanana rivers should be complete by the end of summer. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
For the second year in a row, the number of walrus harvested for subsistence on St. Lawrence Island is far below normal.
It's about half of what the average take has been over the last 10 years or so.
Jim McCracken supervises the walrus program for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Though some hunters are still boating as far as 70 miles north to the retreating ice edge, the majority of walrus pods are now past the island and the preliminary harvest totals are low.
Total for both Gamble and Savunga so far is about 345 animals, but we still are getting a few certificates back in, and I hear that people are picking up a walrus here and then. As they migrate back south in the fall, they may get a few more also.
Based on what McCracken has heard from hunters, the cause of the poor harvest is the same as last year: bad wind and ice conditions. Walrus are the staple subsistence source on the island and an essential economic and cultural resource. Last year, the state declared an economic disaster because of the record low harvest. A federal wildlife technician got a rare treat in Prince William Sound yesterday. Marty Reedy was driving a boat for a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Seabird and Marine Mammal Survey when a colleague pointed out a seal that didn't look quite right. Reedy, who has also worked in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas, knew immediately what the animal was, a ribbon seal.
I just could not believe my eyes. I kept thinking to myself, well, I must be seeing something wrong, but... if you look at a picture of these guys, that's a very distinctive animal. There's no doubt what it was. So, and we see a lot of wonderful stuff out in the Sound, but to see something like that is pretty unique and special.
Reedy drove the boat closer and took a picture of a male ribbon seal hauled out on a piece of glacial ice. He says the animal is in the northwest section of the Sound, but doesn't want to give an exact location. Peter Bovang is a seal expert with the National Marine Mammal Lab in Seattle. He says ribbon seals spend their winters in the Bering Sea and the Sea of Okhotsk, but this time of year they are roamers and have been spotted as far south as British Columbia and Washington. He's not surprised one turned up in Prince William Sound and says the seal is on the fringes of its summer range.
They go into what we call a pelagic phase, or essentially they're in the water all the time. They seem to be more or less solitary, so people don't see ribbon seals really anywhere this time of year with any frequency or commonness.
A ribbon seal was found in Cook Inlet and Anchorage in 2007. Bovang says if this seal is healthy, he should be able to find his way back north to the Bering Sea for the winter breeding season.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
About 1,500 people showed up for an early morning live broadcast of the Today Show from Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier. They waved signs, cheered, and waited hours for a chance to be on national TV for just a few seconds. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, many on the East Coast woke up around 7:30 to this.
From the magnificent Mendenhall Glacier, Natalie, good morning. We're missing you. Tell us what's going on.
Thanks, guys. What a contrast from, you know, Brazil last week to Juneau, Alaska this week.
That's NBC's Today Show news anchor, Natalie Morales.
Hats off to Juneau, because all of these folks, about 1,500 of them, they're here at 3:30 in the morning. So, you guys are incredible. Lots of pride here in Juneau.
When Morales was off camera, she talked to the crowd, held babies, and took pictures with adoring fans.
I feel bad. I mean, they all showed up here at like 3 o'clock in the, no, earlier than that. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. So I want to make sure everybody gets a little camera time, or if not, gets a good selfie out of this.
Juneau resident Neely Perisic arrived at the visitor center at 2:30. She didn't come empty-handed.
My sign says, "Hi, Carrie and Andrea. They live in Newburgh, Oregon. They're my sister and my niece, and they watch the Today Show every day."
The sign has a border of blinking white lights. Perisic is with her partner, Dave Velasquez.
Come on, do it. Look
at
him.
Al mask. I wanted to be Al.
He loves Al.
Velasquez is wearing a cutout of Al Roker's head. He's a big fan of the Today Show co-anchor and weatherman.
So I got an owl head. He's got a perfect shaped head for cutting out on paper. There's no hair or anything.
It's an owl wannabe.
Most of the crowd inside and lining the walls of the pavilion wanted to be there for the excitement, like Tom Chard.
Years later, people are going to be saying, "Well, where were you when you remember the Today Show came around?" Yeah. The line was out the door. We loved it. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Eileen McIver had an ulterior motive for being at the live broadcast. She's a columnist for the Chilkat Valley News in Haines.
I wanted to pitch this idea I have for a sitcom, so I'm here to get the attention of someone from NBC. Not sure who, I don't really have a plan.
McIver is writing a sign on a pizza box.
NBC, you have to hear my pitch, we'll talk.
The broadcast from Juneau kicked off a series, Today Takes Off, which sends Morales to famous destinations around the country. She spent a couple days in Juneau kayaking, ice climbing, exploring the Mendenhall Glacier ice caves, and visiting Admiralty Island bears. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And the cast and crew of the Animal Planet TV show Finding Bigfoot is in Bethel to record eyewitness accounts of the creature known locally as the Hairy Man. KYUK's Charles Enoch reports.
Frida Bean was on a boating trip to Three Step Mountain, riding up the twisting Guithluk River with her husband, when she says something caught her eye on the tree line.
I saw a figure of Bigfoot just standing there staring at me eye to eye. It was a figure of a human being, but way bigger. The head was bigger, rounder, and the arms were bigger too, and hairy.
Bean says she could barely make sense of what she saw.
At first I thought it was a sight of a spirit. Nobody ever told me anything about Bigfoot stories of any kind during that time.
But many in the region grew up hearing stories of the Hairy Man, or Milukuyuluk as it's often called in Yupik, a hairy humanoid creature known to throw things like its own feces, sticks, or rocks at anyone who comes too close. Recently, a local newspaper, the Delta Discovery, began printing a series of witness accounts like these. That caught the attention of Finding Bigfoot co-producer Natalie Hewson.
We chose the YK Delta because there are many, many stories that have come out of the area. There have been news reports, newspaper reports. So with that many reports in one area, it was a big point of interest, so we decided to come out here.
At the Bigfoot gathering, about 100 interested locals begin arriving to listen to what the gathering has to offer. They are asked to sign release forms before going into the conference room. After the cameras were set up and the audience was in place, the shooting begins. The limelight shone while the cameras began rolling, as the stars of the show, Bobo and Matt Moneymaker, enter with applause. The media was asked not to record as the cast began asking the audience members whether or not they've had an encounter with Sasquatch. Half a dozen hands go up and the TV cameras reset on them as they begin telling their stories in front of everyone. Some said they saw Hairy Man, others explained mysterious encounters, and others relayed second-hand accounts. Elizabeth Roll of Bethel says what we hear only scratches the surface.
Something like this, I think this is only just the beginning of the iceberg. If you really went to every village and talked to people there, you'd probably hear 5 or 10 stories.
Some are skeptical, while others believe that so many stories could only mean there is something out there, something big, human-like, and hairy. The audience then left while the cast filmed a scene with the witnesses, documenting the locations of the encounters. Houston says now her team will venture into the YK Delta wilderness to film at some of the locations near Bethel. Whether or not the show finally finds Bigfoot in the Delta, she says the journey itself is worth it.
I think whether or not Bigfoot exists is a very interesting subject. You know, there are a lot of things out there that people have seen that you can't quite explain. And when you can't explain something, you know, we want to try to figure out what it is. And, you know, there's people all over the world that have stories of seeing a Bigfoot-like creature. So I think it's very important for us to continue the search to figure out what this is.
Houston says the material they gather could be used before the end of this season of Finding Bigfoot. Whenever it airs, the show will be the biggest venue yet for the age-old tale of Milukuyuluk. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Lisa Fu in Juneau, Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Joaquin Palomino from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Join chef and author Stephen Reichlin on his visit to Alaska July 25th through the 27th. Reichlin brings his skills from his shows Barbecue University and Primal Grill for events that include a barbecue salmon cook-off, barbecue class and party, as well as a pig roast over lunch. Let's celebrate summer with Stephen Reichlin and Alaska Public Media, sponsored by Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, the Hotel Captain Cook, and Crush Wine Bar and Bistro, a benefit for Alaska Public Media. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA health care benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal health care facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.